And we're live.
Okay, and this is when I'm talking.
And this is when I'm talking.
Alright, great.
But you know what's funny? We never said our names.
Yeah, I'm Shepherd.
And I'm Farid Alsaba. And we are meeting today as part of an interfaith dialogue.
Yeah, I would say.
I agree.
Yes.
Let's see, we already agree.
There you go. That's a hell of a start to a religious discussion. You don't get that enough.
So we're talking about, in terms of our individual subjectivities, what is the core mission that unites us? And I think we came to the conclusion that it was if you think about religion, a very common one, right, among all religions, which is to bring people into a place of faith in God.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fair to say that almost every religion has that kind of a fundamental injunction, that this knowledge of God that you possess, this faith in God, there is something like you need to spread it, or at least you need to contribute to a society where more people can come into it. It's very sort of expansive. I would say most religions are like that.
Yeah, I would say for me it's the idea that it matters what people believe about God.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has individual implications, but also societal implications too.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I would agree with that. So on that note, we said that our core mission was to bring people to faith. And so then we started talking about society and which direction society is going to be going. Because this is why I asked Shepherd what his teleology is, because I wanted to know. We think that society is in disarray now. We think that spirituality is at all-time low. I mean, I think that's a fair statement to make. Scientific materialism is the leading ontology. We believe that we live in a world full of material objects, and something as intimate as even subjective experience, like seeing the color red or feeling pain, people say that's an illusion. So we think that society in disarray, can it get better? What do we have as our wildest kind of future scenario? And so when I asked you about this last time, you said that it's possible that this is just it. This is the sign of the second coming, right? Like, it might just descend into chaos. And I said that, well, there's a point where we disagree, because I think that necessarily part of embracing God is embracing the fact that society is not beyond redemption.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I reached for the microphone.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good place to get your thoughts now.
Yeah, yeah. So is
society past a point of redemption, or can we come back into a acceptance of God?
Yeah. So my answer to that would be, I don't think that society is beyond redemption, but I think the means of the redemption is where we probably would differ, because I think that even from the beginning of God's interactions with people, the pattern is that without his help, without his power, they are not actually able to maintain that state
mm-hmm.
of utopia or living as things are supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
That their tendency is to go away from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, you see that in the creation story in Genesis, humans left to their own devices fall prey to the temptation to turn away from God.
We will pick that apple from the tree. We did it once, we would do it 1,000 times if we repeated it, right? It's our nature.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so I think that, and then even when you see God chooses a people, and he gives them even more specific rules. He gives them the Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm.
He gives them all these laws about social justice. If someone falls off your roof, you're accountable for that,
mm-hmm.
because that was your responsibility to make
right.
sure that didn't happen. So he even gives them more specifics. And even in that trial run, people still, even knowing more specifically, this is actually what goodness is, are not able to do it.
We will always deviate from the law, even when we are told that the law is inherently good. The law of God is good.
We'll inherently deviate from it.
Yeah. So in my mind, knowledge of the law is not enough. So even if you describe to me, because I am curious in what you think utopia actually is, like the idea of something getting better, how do we know what better is? But just having knowledge of that preferred future, I don't think is sufficient for humanity to actually get there on their own.
So how I'm going to respond to that is to say, I agree, and we should now specify what our techniques, what our methodology is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll start.
Yep.
I would say this goes back to the idea that I first mentioned when I first came in, which was the ontological proof of God, which is, very roughly speaking, and I don't even remember who it was who said this, but I'm pretty sure I got the basic idea right, which is the fact that we even have a concept of God as an omnipotent, omniscient agent, mm-hmm. the fact that we can understand the idea of the infinite, the idea of the all-encompassing, of the absolutely beyond us, is proof that that thing exists.
Yeah.
So the fact that we can conceptualize it means that it exists. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So then I think, and this is, remember, all tying back to my like methodology.
Yeah.
Then I think, if that's the case, then getting an individual to think rationally and deeply about what their personal conception of God is, even if they don't believe in him,
mm-hmm.
he will come to insightful places.
Yeah.
And that is part of something that I call like a sacred psychology, mm-hmm. in the sense that it's something to do with your mind that is deeply encoded within even like religious principles.
Mm-hmm.
It's the greatest form of wisdom is knowledge of God.
Mm-hmm.
That is a core psychological belief that has existed in multiple societies and therefore I believe constitutes an archetype.
Mm-hmm.
So to summarize, I would say my methodology is get people to think about their individual conception of God and then follow mm-hmm. the psychological trail that leads them.
Okay. So then in that methodology, what happens if people end up in different ideas of God?
Mm.
So does your methodology follow them along that trail? Like, do you walk with them and offer thoughts and input, or is it more you're just wanting to set them off on a path and knowing that wherever they end up is going to be a good place?
And now we introduce the concept of the state.
Okay.
There we go. That's how it gets political, mm-hmm. because that's precisely the point, right? If you render onto Caesar what is Caesar's, what if Caesar gets up into some bad business and starts to exterminate you?
Mm-hmm.
You can't separate individual faith from the state. So I would say it is precisely the responsibility of the state to prune our individual behaviors such that when left to our own libertarian devices to come to a knowledge of God, we do not come to morally horrendous conclusions.
Okay.
So that is the function of the state. So I agree. I think that that is a problem.
Mm.
And I would say that is when humanity as a collective elects to create, to socially construct the entity of the state, capital S.
Okay.
Because as all German philosophers, you need to be pretentious and be talking about some concept not in the way you mean it.
Yes, of course.
But
the true state.
Yes. The Platonic form of the state.
Yeah. Okay. So then your methodology, the exploration is just the beginning. It's necessary. But then even as people are exploring, there are some places where you would say, don't go there. That's actually a bad place.
And we say that the way that we articulate that is by enacting laws.
Okay.
Like, the enactment of a law is a symbolic process, so it is analogous to language. I can speak that to you and try to convince you, but if I'm talking to a collective, I'm speaking it by symbolizing it on the level of the law, which then influences embodied actions.
Okay.
So then, okay, so what I want to ask you about now, and more get into your kind of philosophy is, mm-hmm. so on a just a daily, outside of all of this philosophical talk, on a daily sort of lived experience level, what is your approach, like what approach have you found is like the most interesting to you, where you're talking to a non-religious person and, you know, maybe you mention this and they seem interested, or, you know, in your experience, again, having a lot of interfaith dialogue. I mean, I met you at a secular student association, right?
Yeah.
So you were there to kind of have those kind of conversations.
Mm-hmm.
What have been some concepts that, or techniques on just like person to person that you found were helpful?
Yeah. Well, I think similar to you, I do want people to explore. I want them to look inside themselves and think about what do I actually think about God? Because I think that, those sort of questions are very powerful, and they're usually very explanatory for why people behave the way they do and the opinions they hold. And so, for example, the meetings that we were at, a lot of the philosophies, I wasn't entirely convinced that someone's belief was just purely because they read it in a book and that logically made sense to them. I think that there's something fundamental about how they think God is, or the way they've experienced God in their life already that form those opinions.
Mm.
And so I think for for someone to have such a firm stance on something but not understand what they think about God and how that influences, that seems like a discrepancy that I like to explore with people. Because for me, I believe it's not that you stumbled upon the one true philosophy and you just happen to uniquely understand it. Mm-hmm. I'm coming in with an assumption of you have a view of God and your conclusions from that have led you to believe that this must be true. But if we can talk about what you actually think about God, if we can talk about what you think God is like, and maybe that's where I'm playing the role of the state, mm-hmm. where I have a very specific idea of the nature of God, of how he treats people, his desire for how he wants people to live, and his desire for interactions with people. And so that is my filter when I'm talking with a person, is I'm thinking, what are the ways in which their life is not actually lining up with or in alignment with the way that God wants us to live? And so like forgiveness is a great example.
Mm-hmm.
On a cultural level, people want to be forgiven for things that they do, but they don't really want to forgive other people for ways that they're hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got an imbalance there of, we're not very consistent with forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
It's very lopsided.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I know that that the character of God is that he does forgive anyone on the basically with the criteria of they're willing to be humble and come to him and basically acknowledge that they did something wrong.
Right.
And so I think a lot of my methodology is I'm just exploring ways that it seems like people's belief differ from, I think, what reality actually is,
mm-hmm.
what God is actually like.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working off the assumption that there is a conviction in us that is in line with how God is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's where I find it helpful to look at, well, what do you actually feel about this? What do you actually feel about God? Because I think God has placed in us a spirit that is sensitive to those sorts of matters.
Mm-hmm. So I have a lot to say about that.
Yeah.
I want to start with this idea that you mentioned on the onset, which was like when people like encounter the Bible and they think of it as, oh, there's this sentence and I either believe it or not. And then it's like, no, people aren't experiencing the Bible like that. They kind of come into it from a place of faith.
Yeah.
It kind of makes me think of like, you know, the classic sort of when you're 13 years old and edgy, you leave religion. It's like when you think about it like Darwinianly, it's like, oh, they say God made the leaves green so because it's a beautiful color. You know, and they say, wait a minute, no, wait. According to Darwin, leaves are green because of these completely random physical processes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, green just happened to be the best color for them to survive.
Yeah, it's like a meaningless sort of just shots in the dark that die mm-hmm. and wither and decay and grow again.
Yeah.
And I think they read that and then they can't help but look back to the Bible and say, oh, so the Bible is just a shitty attempt at trying to explain this idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's literally what it is. It's like they elevate the scientific materialist account to their highest place, and then they can't help but interpret the Bible as something that's trying to be empirical,
mm-hmm.
or as the cliche is, you know, these you know, pre-industrious, even barbaric people who were trying to make sense of this crazy world around them. But now we're sophisticated. We have science. We can explain everything.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually this is the article that's Scientific Materialism and Religion.
Yeah.
The idea behind that one was you can't help but look back and believe that that's what religion always was, because you're viewing it fundamentally from the scientific materialist perspective,
yeah.
which claims that religious texts are just literally, they think it's just a shitty attempt at being empirical. No, there are sacred injunctions and ways to view your life and ways to, and this is where we disagree, right? Because you're a Christian,
mm-hmm.
and I'm a Muslim who, I would call myself a libertarian Muslim. I think that we should all be Muslims, but just go home and pray and like never talk about our Islam to anyone else.
Okay.
That really is my closest thing. It's like,
okay.
So for me, I think that they're a lot more abstract. You can even think of it as like, I guess like if you think of it archetypically, like we have different archetypes. You have the strictly Christian archetypes, and I'm saying maybe there are archetypes that transcend that
mm-hmm.
are, you know, here's what I'll call them, proto-religious archetypes,
mm-hmm.
where it's like even before we articulated a religion, we were just all going around telling each other, this is how to, and here we're going to agree with this,
mm-hmm.
this is how to stay on the straight path,
mm-hmm.
the path of not eating the fruit from the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't believe that that's possible, of course, because we all have original sin, but through faith in Jesus Christ, we can reach that.
Well, I think that I might put it in a slightly different way. I think it depends who gets to decide what is good enough.
Mm-hmm.
So, I do believe that as a human society, we could come up with rules and that we could all follow those rules. I think that's possible. I think what would happen, though, is the rules will have to be, there'll be compromises.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that when I think about being good enough for God, that's a different thing in my mind than being good enough for what society might think is good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can always rearrange, and I think we do this individually too. We start out the new year with some sort of resolution of like, I firmly believe it will be better for my life and my family if I work out every day. Mm-hmm. And you believe it, and you're going to do it, and mm-hmm. then you don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then so you say, well, maybe just once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually you land at like either not doing it or you find some compromise, but you've fallen from the ideal. You've fallen mm-hmm. from the truest, purest form of what you actually thought would have been good.
So I want to try to like restate what you said and see if you agree with this restatement.
Yeah.
It's almost like, as humans, the functional activity that is sort of whatever I described earlier, the straight path, sort mm-hmm. of the non-sin, right,
yeah.
is not actually functionally possible. We can't do it. We're always sort of taking shortcuts and making idealizations and it's something that only exists in our minds, which is to say, we only can be saved if we believe in Christ, right? It's like, it's not about what actions you do. So there's a difference too, because for me, I put a little more emphasis, I would say, on doing good deeds.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentally, I mean, obviously we can both say that people should go out and do good things, but I'm saying philosophically, for you, and we've talked about this paradox before. It's an interesting one in Christianity, where it's like someone who has, and of course it's dramatic, but all thought experiments are dramatic.
Yeah.
He's murdered and plundered for 90 years of his life. He had hundreds of kids. They will continue to murder and plunder. But then mm-hmm. the night before he dies, he reads the Bible and he genuinely, wholeheartedly accepts the word of God.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that guy technically is going to heaven, whereas someone who, let's say, was, and this is all theoretically speaking, right,
mm-hmm.
was, you know, sort of a normal person, you know, did his business, didn't really bother anyone, didn't really do anything great either, but whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't a Christian, though. He never really thought about God. He was more of like a weird agnostic sort of, I don't know. He's going to hell,
mm-hmm.
right? But the one who did all of that harm on earth
mm-hmm.
because of a little loophole where he thought, and it was genuine, so maybe it's disingenuous of me to say loophole, but because he had his mind in a certain way before he died,
mm-hmm.
he's going to heaven. So for me, I think that your acts in life carry a little more weight from than that. You know, I think that there's mm-hmm. something fundamental about the fact that if you commit bad acts, I think it's a what's the opposite of purify? It taints it.
Yeah, taints it.
Soils the soul.
And maybe like destroy or distorts.
Maybe something like that. But it's not good for us.
Yeah.
It somehow damages the soul, I would say.
Yeah.
So I'm suspicious of this idea that it's just about, you know, it's just about faith. I think there's something more subtle there.
Yeah.
Potentially.
I wouldn't say it's just about faith, because I think that is a good metaphor or picture to think about. But I think that part of that is, I don't know if false dichotomy is the word, but it's not that it doesn't matter what we do here. It's more that the implications of what we do here are much more far-reaching than just this life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's part of what seems so absurd about that example, is that it really depends on your view of eternity and of heaven. And the heart of that, the difference between those two people, is that it kind of depends on... I'm finally arriving at the thought. When you tell that story, you're inviting someone to be the judge of which of those people should deserve to get something.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole point of Christianity is that God is the one who is the judge.
Mm-hmm.
He is the one who gets to decide. And so that feels like a big difference to me. that story feels like saying, we know mm-hmm. what is, we mm-hmm. know what is right. The best thing would have been for someone to have spent their whole earthly life doing good things,
right.
and that person deserves something. And so in that story is injected this idea of, I know what is valuable, I know what mm-hmm. is the best, and obviously God is doing something weird here,
so
which
I will
he
say
is.
This. I have to say, even before you made your argument, I knew I was fucked. Oh man, I thought I wasn't going to sort of what.
Just bleep it out later.
Yeah, sure, maybe. I potentially might do that.
Do you watch The Good Place?
No, what's that?
You gotta watch The Good Place. It's a TV show.
Uh-huh.
The story is, you know, edit this out too. So four people show up in The Good Place,
mm-hmm.
and basically they die, and it's just like about them in the afterlife. It's
oh,
hilarious.
Wow.
It's and like one of them is an ethics professor. And so
that's a, honestly,
you would love it.
Spending time in the afterlife with an ethics professor sounds like a very fun idea.
Yeah, but anyway, in the show, in The Good Place, there's no swearing. So every time they try to swear, they say like bench or forked.
Mm-hmm.
It's really fun.
Well, that's what I said. I said forked.
Yeah, exactly.
That's fake news if you heard otherwise.
Okay, sorry. I'll let you continue.
But where were we?
You knew from even before I started talking.
Yeah, because you said it's a false dichotomy, and literally the tagline of my blog is beyond dichotomy. And I was like, fuck, if I really made a dichotomy, then yeah, he got me. And no, you know what? I agree because I literally felt like a hypocrite because I also deeply, in my knowledge of God, I deeply believe that he is the judge of judges, and any attempt to rationalize his judgment is hubris and mm-hmm. arrogant because we are saying that we have some kind of impression of what it might be. So if something is intuitively paradoxical for us humans,
mm-hmm.
it's not necessarily paradoxical for him. He is
yeah.
he is the all-knowing of the judges,
yeah.
not you. So, but you know, I think that's part of the idea of the book of Job, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. It's,
because
the,
Job
the...
fundamentally commits that hubris, right? When he curses at God.
Mm-hmm.
Because he finally felt like, oh wait, no, this there's something about it that doesn't make sense, you know? That's why mm-hmm. he went against God. The minute he let that out, that's when he cursed God, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, God convinces him otherwise. But so yeah, it's about the idea that we don't. I'm sorry, I cut you off. What was it you wanted to say?
Oh, I was just saying, yeah, Job's a great example of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as always, we come to the book of Job because it's a doozy. Remember
mm-hmm.
when I mentioned like sacred psychology
mm-hmm.
and how there are these like fundamental sort of archetypes or ideas that should be central to your thinking about God is mm-hmm. Book of Job is definitely one of them in
mm-hmm.
insofar as it's the question of why is it that human reality can be so unjust.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing stopping the injustice. You would think that, you know, if God was all good, that anytime someone tried to do something unjust to another person, it would just disappear magically, right? And
mm-hmm.
then we would all say, damn, I guess we can't do that, and we would do something else.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, that's something that also brings up free will, because then what the argument to that is, well, you wouldn't have free will, necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
We have to choose to, that's a Clockwork Orange, actually.
Yeah.
Man,
well, and also, too,
a minute. Go ahead.
I think another distinction is, I don't distinguish, and I don't think the scriptures distinguish either, between something that someone intends in their heart and whether they actually do it or not.
Mm.
And so there is a sense in which the person who has already decided to do that, whether they succeed or not, they've already made that decision.
Mm-hmm.
They've already determined, said in their heart, I'm not going to follow God. And so I think that also falls under the realm of, and again, I think that's part of why this utopia, maybe you could keep people from acting on their desires.
Mm-hmm.
You can make sure that no one hurts each other.
Mm-hmm.
But people still internally are still participating in that sort of destructive going away from the path.
Interesting.
And you can't keep them from doing that.
Interesting.
You could encourage them not to. You could give them all the arguments of, like, this is why you shouldn't try to sleep with your neighbor's wife. Like,
right.
Societal implications, individual implications.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing that you can stop them from fantasizing about that and dreaming about that. And that individual internal action will still take its toll on
mm-hmm.
it, on themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So here's, I'm not sure why, but this is what that invoked in me.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that in the Old Testament days, when prophets were speaking, they did have some kind of a utopic state in mind, right? Because the whole point was that, you know, we as a people were once informed by the law of God given to us by Moses, and
mm-hmm.
we have been led astray from that law. So it was always like, the law needs to be this, the law needs to be this. In the Christian, so that's the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
The New Testament in the Christian age, it's not like that at all. It's more of the individual sort of faith aspect, right? So, and this is my point, which is that it kind of seems like when you look at it from that perspective, we can only fall. It can only get dystopic. Maybe I agree with you. Maybe from that perspective, it can only go into disarray. Mm-hmm. But what if that means we just have to go back to the law-giving days and start to intermix religion and law? Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds crazy, but the whole point is that we are speaking from a level where we're thinking about our society now in a scientific materialist sense. Just because we say something that invokes the idea of a autocratic theological society in the past doesn't mean it has to be that way in the future. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's what we're doing, is we're acknowledging the kind of peculiar times we're in. Because yeah. They are peculiar times, certainly. So what do you think about that? The idea of would you be opposed? Here's a way to pose the question. Okay. Would you be opposed to a Christian state and advocating for a Christian state?
That's a great question. Hmm. To what end? Why would you want it?
Well, the end that I had in mind was to bring people to faith in God.
Okay.
But I guess that you could argue that, you know, why do we have to do that? Although we did say it was our mission.
Yeah. No, I think, but that's the sort of filter I'm looking for, is mm-hmm. What is the thing you're hoping it would accomplish? Mm-hmm. So I think if the goal was to bring people to God.
Oh, and here's an important point. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah. It's like to do that such that we do not fall into the disarray of a completely godless mm-hmm. anarchistic society.
Yeah.
Let's say, assuming that that is possible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do think there's a lot of examples of a microcosm of this when you look at a Christian family. Because that is a sense of a Christian state. Mm. You've got the subjects of the state, which are the children, mm-hmm. and they really are not free to do what they wish. Mm-hmm. They can think what they want, but they can't do what they want.
Right.
And so I think that there can be some good effects of that, in the sense that a lot of Christian parents successfully filter the world in a way that their kids are not exposed to things that might lead them away from God, or maybe they're not mature enough yet to wrestle with something, and so they don't have to because they're not being bombarded with it. Mm-hmm. So I think there's definitely advantages to having the leadership of some organization be making decisions that he or she feels like would be good for the people in that
right.
state. But I think you also see what happens in Christian families when the grip is too tight, is that mm-hmm. inevitably the children leave.
Oppression reads rebellion. That's
yeah.
what I would say.
So I do think that there is something, and maybe this comes back to free will, but there's something about the nature of God and that he really wants his creation to choose him. And so I think if you institute a state where there is no choice possible and you must choose this thing, I think inherently we don't do well under those circumstances, and it ends up backfiring. So I think if the goal of the Christian state was just, we think life would be better for everyone if we follow these principles, please do them. Like, yeah, I mean, that's kind of like the country we live in right now.
I see.
Is there's some sort of cultural, moral agreements we've made that
yeah.
are somewhat biblically based.
Yeah.
But I think if it got to the point of you can't live here unless you profess faith in God, I think in a lot of ways that's going against his actual desire for
right.
how we're interacting with each other.
You know what I would say is this is very reminiscent of the recent push you have ideologically to emphasize Judeo-Christian values.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You heard that a lot in like centrist and moderately right circles. Like, we need to, you know, remember our roots. This is what we are, right?
Yeah.
It could very well be the initial stages of a more, you know, politically powerful movement to say that our opposition is moving away from Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So maybe that's an interesting sort of way to ponder about what the future state of religion will be, because maybe the emphasis on Judeo-Christian values is it's an emerging way to distinguish one party from another. Right?
Yeah.
Because then they say, you know, the Democrats aren't acknowledging that. And then for the political expediency of symbolizing something against their enemies, they might say, we are the Christians and they are the non-Christians.
Yeah, totally. I think that happens all the time.
Mm.
I think that even just that, like, oh no, Christian values are disappearing. Like, what a vague mm-hmm. thing to say. But somehow I could see how that could terrify people. Like, oh no, what will happen then mm-hmm. if the Christian values aren't preserved?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think there's a lot of ways in which that sort of thinking has been used for corrupt purposes, scare tactics.
Do you want to know my fantasy?
Yes, I do.
My fantasy for the future is that what ends up happening is we come to a synthetic place, and the law is relegated to the Christian faith because they, you know, maybe they establish the best sort of democratic system of governance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Personal introspection into God is a Muslim base, because I think that, and I am convinced that we've developed sort of more mystical, mm-hmm. you know, ways into the depths of your idea of God that will ultimately lead you to elevate wisdom of God as the great, or knowledge of God as the greatest wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
God, that's so beautiful. And then Hinduism in some way that I don't understand.
But it's right? just involved
yeah, yeah.
somehow.
And like confusion, yeah. It's like, listen, I understand the limits of my ideas, okay? But something like that, you know, something like that. And then we say, well, there are no differences between the religions, because mm-hmm. each one is contributing to our society.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a functional truth of the future, where it's like, but how can you think that these are different? Christianity tells us how to live, our laws. Islam tells us how to look into ourselves. And then long pause for Hinduism. I should really get, you know what I want? I want a really sort of philosophical take on Hinduism. So I mm-hmm. want to talk to Hindus and Buddhists and see what they can tell me about their own history. That'll be the next interfaith dialogues.
Yeah. So I'm interested in what you're saying with Islam being looking inward, and like, can you say more about that? Like, what you mean by that? Like, what is that? What's so captivating about that? What feels different than Christianity there?
So what feels different from Christianity is, I think it's possible to read the Quran as a manual for coming to knowledge of God.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, the whole Quran isn't like that. There are a lot of verses in the Quran where it's literally like, okay, if you have a witness to this, you have to have this many witnesses and split your cattle like this and do that. You know, it's more administrative stuff. But
yeah.
There are jewels in the Quran in terms of, here are the core sort of principles of what the Almighty is. And I'm glad we came to this, because I think this is something originally that we wanted to try to see if we can agree on.
Yeah.
The first of these is fear of God.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I like to start with that one is because it gives it kind of some real emphasis, and it freaks atheists out.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely freaks atheists out, because I think we've painted God too much in a good light. I mean, I know that technically it's like hellfire and whatever, but we always say like, God loves you. And it's like, listen, mm-hmm. God loves you, but you fear the Almighty.
Yeah.
You fear the Almighty. So, and I think that you start with that one. I think we've established that one, fear of God. And God is the all-seeing and all-knowing. That's mm-hmm. an important one, too.
Yeah.
Which is, you fear him. And here's the really interesting part that ties into the Christian idea of sin.
Mm-hmm.
And sin being in your mind, and sin being something that permeates you. It's, mm-hmm. listen, you fear him, and he knows everything about you. Yeah, you'll fear someone that knows everything about you.
Yeah, totally.
You'll fear, and the thing is, it's in the Quran. Oh, yeah, he listens. إِنَّهُ يَعْلَمُ الْجَهْرَ وَمَا يَخْفَى. He knows what is said in public and what is hidden.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that if someone engages with God on that level,
mm-hmm.
they will go to places, and they will come to conclusions. And it will be hard, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, completely agree.
Yeah, and it'll be something that's more of a journey, I would say. Because I don't want people to get the idea that it's like, oh, you open the door and then you're in faith. No, I like the idea of Israel wrestling with God.
Mm-hmm.
We're grappling with religious ideas. The difference between a non-religious and a religious person is a religious person is the one doing the grappling. Mm-hmm. The non-religious person doesn't do the grappling.
Yeah.
You know? But anyway, so that's what I mean by the Quran, I think, having these kind of core fundamental elements of contributing to some kind of like a sacred psychology, where you mm-hmm. think in a certain way and it gets you to a certain place. And I could go on and on about it. If I had to list them, I would say that, like, in terms of verses that I would pick as being like here, I'll give you another one. I can mm-hmm. do this one, and then we can get what your take on it is, because I know I've been talking for a while. Sirat al-Mustaqim, the straight path.
Mm-hmm.
This one, actually, I will give it to you, because this came up earlier and I want to know what you think about this. Me, I think that it's possible to follow a straight path while you're living.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't necessarily think that that's a path outside of sin.
Mm-hmm.
Christians would agree with that, because they would say, you're right, you are living in a certain way, but you will be saved through your knowledge, through your faith in God.
Mm-hmm.
So the Sirat al-Mustaqim to me is that path that emanates from your decision to have faith in God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I'm catching where the difference is. The difference is, faith in God or faith in his son, and the fact that his son died for your sins.
Mm-hmm.
What is it, and this is where I'll give it to you, what is it about faith in the fact that he did that that saves you, as opposed to just faith in him and fearing him and carrying out what your duty is after you go through the introspective journey of understanding God? Mm-hmm. Why is it that you have to believe that his son did so-and-so in order to be saved and be on the straight path?
Yeah, that's a great question. So basically, why Jesus? Why is Jesus necessary?
The age-old the question that missionaries love to add. Have you seen those Jehovah's Witnesses? Where it's like they're outside in Ann Arbor and they have these signs like, who is God? Like, was I created? And they're selling out like pamphlets.
I haven't seen that, but I'm...
Really? They're in Ann Arbor everywhere.
Yeah. I don't walk around campus a lot usually.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because I don't live here anymore.
Right, yeah. And also, it's campus, like downtown campus. Like you would only be going if you were going to a class. Yeah. But yeah, it's hilarious. I love that idea though. I love that they're out there and they're like ready to have conversations.
Mm-hmm.
I've never talked to one because I'm afraid that I'll find out that they're really dumb and I'll be disappointed. Like at least like open-minded, I'll say. That dumb wasn't fair. I would say like closed-minded. But
yeah. Yeah, it probably depends on who you talk to.
Oh yeah, like most things.
Yeah.
But okay, yeah. So the age-old question: why Jesus?
I'm going to think about that for a second.
Yeah, of course. While you're doing that, I'm just going to say something. You don't have to listen, but
yeah. This
is something I like, is the fact that, you know, let it breathe. Let it breathe. You see a lot on CNN sound clips. It's like they're trying to go back at it. Pow, pow, pow. It's like, no. It's like you ask a question. Sometimes you let it breathe. You think about it. I think that is something that isn't a social norm that should be.
Okay, are you there?
We can add some more. At the beginnings, yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, we'll see where this ends up.
All right.
So, part of it is, all throughout the Old Testament and the Scriptures, they don't say the word Jesus. They don't say there's a guy named Jesus who's going to be born. But there is a lot of prophetic testimony to this idea that the way that humanity is going to be saved is through this kind of superhero figure, this mysterious figure. And you see this all over the writings in Isaiah. You see this even actually immediately in the creation story in Genesis. As right after the humanity falls, there's this kind of this pronouncement by God where he informs the men and the humanity, because of what you've done, now all creation is likewise cursed with you. So you've entered into this space outside of my protection, outside of my will, and there's consequences to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he tells them that. But then he also curses the serpent, and he says that there will be this man who comes, and he will crush your head. But you will bruise his heel.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in the first, you know, three chapters of the Bible, there's this amazing promise of this terrible thing has happened, but it won't last forever, and something is coming that will undo this, that will redeem this.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is part of where... then maybe that's part of where we differ in our view of the Old Testament, is I don't view the Old Testament as just a bunch of laws. Like, woven throughout the entire thing, Israel's hope is this Messiah, this Christ figure, who has been promised, and that is their ultimate hope. So do they understand this all the time? Do they live out of that all the time? Or do they not get confused and think it's about the law? Like, no. Yeah, I'm here.
Hello.
Yeah.
That's okay, it's spontaneous.
So it's all over the Old Testament, this idea that somehow this figure is going to be the way that redemption happens.
I only interrupt because I think there's actually something you could say that's really relevant to this. Hebrews 10.
Mm-hmm.
When you told me about them like doing the sacrifices, but it's not enough, but they're still going through it.
Right.
And that being like a functional prophecy to the idea of having faith in God as, or having faith in Jesus as God's Lamb.
Yeah.
Would you say that's an example of that?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's post-Jesus, people are looking back and they're saying, oh, Jesus was it. Jesus mm-hmm. was that figure.
Yeah.
And you see before Jesus comes in the Old Testament, there's even some scriptures, really weird scriptures that talk about this Messiah figure is a person, is a man, but he's also going to be seated at the right hand of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so... That does not make any sense, because why should a sinful person get to be equated and have co-authority with God mm-hmm. in his place of authority. So there's all sorts of weird things like that where it's like, this is a really weird Messiah that's coming. I don't understand this. Mm-hmm. But when Jesus comes and he is man and God, those things make sense.
Right. It's and this is where I get kind of Hegelian with it, but it's almost like Christ is the thing that retroactively saved those before him who adhere to the law.
Right.
Because at the time, and you say time in quotes, right? Because to God, you know, God is above time, transcending
yeah,
time.
Right.
In time, it seemed like there was once a time where it was, futile. Mm-hmm. You know, what are you doing? You think, and that's the impression I got from Hebrews 10. It was very emotional. It was like, you really think that these disgusting animal parts are gonna yeah. are gonna make a good sacrifice for the Almighty God?
Right.
No, hell no. Hell no. Wow, that's really ironic. You know, I've been curious about whether or not, we'll talk about that later, but like, mm-hmm. saying hell and God and all that stuff. You might be onto something or you think it's a little heretical, but So the idea is that Christ as a figure retroactively made their actions actually worthy of redemption.
Mm-hmm.
But that would mean that you're not entirely opposed to the idea that people before Christ could be saved.
No, I think that Hebrews talks about that. I think it says that people before Christ were looking forward to him mm-hmm. in the same way that we are looking back to him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that people before Christ couldn't be saved. It's that the way that they were interacting with that promise is different than we now interact with that promise. And so that was my answer of why Jesus.
That's
because as a person living in this point in time, that Christ redemptive figure has come.
Mm-hmm.
And I am living in the aftermath of that coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so so in some ways the rules or the stakes have changed where because I'm living in the part of time where he's already come, and his command and his teachings and the people he taught and the things he established, mm-hmm. that is where I'm basing my mm-hmm. no, it has to involve Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you have Jesus saying, no one comes to the Father except through me. I am the way, I am the truth, mm-hmm. I am the life. No one comes to the Father except through mm-hmm. me. When you have him establishing himself as, I am the way that someone comes to God now, that is a complete game changer and a complete shift in how people are relating with God.
I accept that argument, and that's why it's so exciting, because now I think we can move further to the big question, which is the idea of prophetic eras. Are you then saying that Jesus was necessarily the last prophet? And I want a yes or no, because I just want your intuitive answer, then we can get into it.
Oh, okay, yes.
He is the last one. Okay,
yeah.
So this is my point.
But I know that Islam and Christianity use the word prophet differently.
Mm-hmm. And this is exactly the place where I'm going to go, which is to say, in Islam, you can agree with everything you just said, but just say, hey, it was that at the time, Jesus was conducting himself as if he was the incarnated logos of God.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning to say that his activities were themselves, if you symbolized it, they are the activities that would make, you know, the kingdom of heaven on earth. Of course, mm-hmm. not everyone can be Jesus, so that's probably not going to happen. But in theory, right?
Mm-hmm.
And by believing that he was the logos of God, you will come to be saved.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in Islam, the idea of a prophet is just that they are divinely inspired.
Mm-hmm.
That is what it is. So that's why we're very... There's a verse in the Quran. It actually speaks directly to the Christians, and it says, and they say that the Almighty has taken a son. Mm-hmm. Nonsense. We are all just honored servants.
Mm-hmm.
In the Islamic conception, Jesus was a highly honored servant of God.
Mm-hmm.
Highly honored servant. Even his activity, right? And that's what we think that you mean when you say that he's the incarnation of God, which is more than Muhammad, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
His very activity itself, the way that he dealt in the world, was symbolic of the Logos. Now, Muhammad, and here's the vital point.
Mm-hmm.
Muhammad's divine inspiration was limited to Logos, where he was receiving verbal injunctions and saying them to people.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was. It never... At the heart of Islam, it's not that, and maybe some people will disagree, but the way I think of my sort of theological perspective is Muhammad didn't maybe act out the functional features of the Logos of God,
mm-hmm.
but he received them, right? And that's why I'm a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
He received them, and I treat the Quran like he received them.
Yeah.
And so that's the way that we think of the whole, created by God thing. So we say that, why say that he's created by God? Because the whole point is that he's just an incarnation of the Logos, which is to us a prophet. Mm-hmm. So really now the question is on you, which is, and this is, I actually talked to Namjoon. Have you met Namjoon?
Not yet.
Yeah, yeah. I talked to him about this, and the way that I phrased it to him was, I'm trying to remember where we were when I said this. Oh, what does it mean to be the Son of God? Like, can you point to it physically? Is it a physical thing that exists out there? Or is it more of your intimate connection with the concept of Christ itself? Because if it's the second one, then I would say, fine. As a Muslim, what we do is we believe that he was the incarnation of the Logos in action and in speech, mm-hmm. not the Son of God. Mm-hmm. But maybe the idea of the Son of God is the idea of elevating someone in your mental space to that level and emulating his actions to that level. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what does it mean to be the Son of God then, apart from that?
Mm-hmm. Son of God meaning the thing that Jesus claimed to be?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So could Muhammad also be considered the Son of God?
Absolutely not. And it would actually be completely heretical in Islam to say that.
Okay.
Yeah. Because the whole point is that God is above and beyond. To say that he begat the most famous, I wouldn't say most famous, but one of the most well-quoted verses in the Quran is, say that God is one, the all-sustaining, mm-hmm. he was not born, and he did not give birth.
Yeah.
So that's my point. My point is, and I think, and this is ultimately where now we're coming to the core boundary of our religions, because that's what I believe it means for Jesus to be the Son of God. I mean, I think it means that in action and speech, he was so perfect that you need to elevate him to that level in your mind. And that's the idea behind when you have faith in the fact that he was the Son of God, then you are on the straightforward path.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can still be on the straightforward path if you're a Muslim,
mm-hmm.
because you believe that Christ was a prophet of God, right? Still an honored servant, still a man, but one that had these kind of characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we just reached across the aisle there. That was really fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to talk more about this. I just have to leave in like 3 minutes.
No, we can wrap this up. So do you want this to be potentially what the question is for next time, or do you want to talk about this?
Yeah, because I want some time to think about that.
Yeah. Would you agree that the idea of Jesus being the Son of God is one of the core sort of differentials between Christianity and other religions? Because that's really it. It's like God came incarnated in this one time and place. So I think that really is the question of Christianity. It's the whole axis by which it pivots. What does that mean? What are the ramifications of that?
Especially when you're talking about the difference between, I think, from what it might be misunderstanding you, but at least between Christianity and Islam, was Jesus actually God?
Mm-hmm.
Or was he a highly honored servant who was certainly embodying the characteristics of God and on the earth showing people this is what God is like, but wasn't actually God? Would you say that would be the one of the differences?
That is the question. Yeah.
Okay.
That is the question.
Yeah.
And I literally hear. I want to write that down so that next time we can begin with that.
Yeah. So basically, is Jesus God or is he highly honored servant embodying God?
Amazing.
Yeah, because I totally understand that if he's just embodying God, if he's just a highly exalted servant, then Muhammad coming and bringing a greater revelation, bringing a better word of God that is still consistent with God but is different and is kind of like surpassing and is like a greater revelation. That makes sense to me.
Beautiful.
If you don't believe that Jesus is God.
Beautiful. And on that note, I'll leave you to it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Fareed Alsaba.
I'm Shepherd Smith.
And this was a Pro for Me podcast, I guess. So thank you.